Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and today I'm having a conversation with Betsy West. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, Dennis. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We're going to begin the show, as we talked about a little bit in the pre-show. This is the 2nd of April, 2020. I am in Austin, Texas, on our own stay-at-home. You are in Manhattan, in one of the epicenters of the coronavirus. Tell me about both your state of mind and of what you're thinking about as a producer and as a writer and a creator, and how you're shaping this as you're watching this convergence. So why don't you take that first?
Wow. Well, it's great to be on your show. I'm kind of taking it step by step, which is maybe something I learned from Justice Ginsburg in doing that story.
Yeah.
She had a very deliberate step-by-step approach, and that's really how my husband and I have been taking the situation we find ourselves in here in Morningside Heights in Manhattan, near Columbia University, where we've been in our apartment for the past 3 weeks.
Yes.
You know, I feel that this kind of, in a way, crept up on us. I was concerned starting in January, but I have to admit I didn't predict the severity of what we would be undergoing. And as older Americans, we're taking it very seriously. Frankly, I feel, Dennis, very lucky because I am in my comfortable apartment and my husband and I are both safe and sound and we have food and supplies. Our daughter lives in rural Montana and she's okay. And I'm, you know, I look at the news and I see what's happening all over my city and all over the world. And that is so upsetting. The people who are in the grocery stores delivering the food to us, the sirens that we hear going out there, you know, pretty regularly, and you know somebody is really in trouble. And certainly, you know, I know several people who have gotten the virus and have died. I don't know them well, but certainly people I know. And I know an awful lot of people who have the virus and have gotten through it, including my own directing partner, Julie Cohen, who's been in her apartment in Brooklyn and pretty surely had coronavirus, a relatively mild case, but she kept herself quarantined from her husband because she didn't want him to get it. He has a little bit of an asthma condition, and so she was being very careful. I'm very happy she's okay, and the other people I know who've gotten it are okay. But wow, what a time. Go ahead.
And we look at this, and it doesn't appear to me, as we were talking before, as a 71-year-old man who has gone through at least the Vietnam era and then through some of the other challenges that we have, it doesn't appear as if we're going to be able to come out of this on the same way that we came out of others, that it's no longer going to be business as usual. Is that just I'm wired optimistic, but it just seems to me that that this is exposing some underbellies of what we're going to be looking at in the future. What's your sense of that?
Yeah. I mean, I think about this a lot. How is our world going to change as a result of this? You know, are people going to be comfortable going out to restaurants? Are we going to get used to doing our work on Zoom, which is what I have been doing? I mean, the other thing I can say that, you know, why I feel lucky now is that I have work that's really occupying me. And I've never, you know, it's distracting when you have to do your work and you can't be constantly focusing on what's going on outside. And my work has become virtual. I'm teaching a small group of documentary students at Columbia University who are facing a huge challenge because they were making verite documentaries, going around the store, the city, and filming people's lives and stories. And now they're under orders by the university not to be doing any in-person reporting because they're not essential workers. And so they have to figure out how to complete their thesis requirement doing a documentary virtually online. And I'm trying to help them do that and bring in guests. And that's hugely challenging. And then my partner, Julie, and I are working on two documentaries now for which we had done a lot of the filming, luckily. And so the editing of those is continuing, but, and our teams meet every morning, one team at 10, one team at 10:30, the editor, the associate editor, the producer, and the archive editor. And we just go through everything we're doing in our day, and we're on Google Docs, and people upload clips. It's amazing how we're working together while we're apart. And I guess you wonder, ongoing, how much of our life is going to become like that, and how reluctant are people going to be to, let's say, go to a big gathering, go to a theater,
right.
You know, get together the way we have been. It's very hard to predict the impact that this is going to have, and I think you're right. It's just going to be so consequential, hard to know.
And is it interesting in your students, when you look at your students and when they talk, when they're talking about this, are they doing their own individual documentation or thinking about how they can, like, were you there when it happened? Actually, I was, and here we go.
Yeah, I think some of them are looking, keeping track of their own experiences, and they've had some dramatic experiences, and we've encouraged them to do that. You know, in one case, student who had to evacuate a residence or an international graduate school residence at Columbia where there were two cases of the virus, and suddenly everybody was just ordered out, and he went to Colorado, but he has an elderly grandmother, so he didn't want to see her, and he got an Airbnb for, and then he got kicked out of that and had to find another one to isolate himself. I mean, he was keeping track of all of this. And another one of my students lives with her mother in a housing project here in New York, and her mother is an essential worker, and her mother is going out every day and working. And she's documenting that experience while she's inside trying to do her work virtually. Her mother's going in and out. I mean, there are just so many stories. One of my students had just started filming a story at a school in the Lower East Side where 50% of the students, it's an elementary school, 50% of the students are considered homeless. They either live in a shelter or they live, you know, with relatives or with friends.
Exactly.
And now they're all home, and they're home, right? Home, being told to work virtually. And so my student is in touch with them on FaceTime and Zoom and trying to day by day document what this is like for those students and for their teachers. So, yes, this is the biggest story in a long, long time, and it's happening all around my students, and they're trying to grab onto their small piece of it to be able to make some sense of it.
Gosh, thank you. Thank you for giving me that perspective, because this really is a work in progress, and so now on April, that's where we know on April the 2nd, that you are and we are safe. My wife and I are safe here in Austin, Texas. And again, we feel very fortunate that there is that we have this. And I'm trying to keep my perspective and to keep my going forward, knowing what is it that we can do and what is it mine to do, and what can we figure out, like you are. All right. Well, I want to pivot at the moment so that we have this, so that when we are on the other side, that this part of the story, because Betsy, I was so interested in you because of your journey in journalism, your journey in the media, very much parallels the time when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was either arguing these cases in front of the court or actually getting on the Supreme Court. So I would like to talk with you real time about your life and experience, and what was your awareness of the gender inequity and the challenges that you had as you got into broadcasting in 74, how it looked then, and what you were doing in your own growth along that span. So could you take me back to that time of what it looked like so that we can let the audience understand really clearly from your perspective what it looked like from yours?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm happy to. You know, I graduated from college in 1973, graduate school in 1974, and, you know, the opportunities for women were just expanding, and I was well aware of that. I you know, my mother had been a very supportive stay-at-home wife who, you know, helped my dad in his career as a teacher and as a head of a school, and that's how she saw her role. I saw mine very differently. I saw that I could go out and have my own career and make my own way in the world, and there was just no question I was going to do that. I was very aware of the fact that the women's movement had opened up opportunities for me and other young women. You know, graduate schools had lifted quotas on women, and, you know, women were starting to go into the professions. At that point, I think that many of us in the sort of 70s and the 80s were in a way so grateful. I was very grateful for the opportunities that I had, that I really just kind of put blinders on to any sort of discrimination. I really felt at the time that we were going into the pipeline and we were working as hard as we possibly could. We were proving ourselves. And, you know, we were going to be able to make our way. And I don't think in 1975 I could have foreseen the obstacles that it's obvious that women still faced working in an old boys' club environment. We just kind of sloughed it off. And when the whole Me Too thing happened a few years ago, it really surfaced for women of my generation. It surfaced so many memories of what we just put up with. We thought it was the price of entry for getting to do these really interesting jobs. You know, I was working at a radio station, and then I went to work for ABC News and eventually became a producer for ABC News and for Nightline. And, you know, in the 80s, I was traveling the world. I mean, I had such a wonderful job, and I really didn't think about pushing back against the kind of what I now see, harassment, sexism, discrimination, that I think a lot of women face. You know, I felt like, hey, I'm advancing in my career. I'm doing pretty well here. It's okay. And then when you look back on it, and you have a different perspective and see that really at the very highest levels, while there are a lot of women in the business and kind of producing and middle management levels, that very few women really calling the shots. And why is that exactly? You know, how did that happen? So yes, I have a very different feeling about it now. But boy, when I got my first job at WHEN Radio in Syracuse, New York, in 1974, it was fantastic. Yeah. I was not aware of what Ruth Bader Ginsburg was doing as a litigator in the Supreme Court, fighting the battle for gender equality. I was completely oblivious to that. No idea. You know, yeah, and it wasn't until, you know, sort of skipping forward to after my network career, and we can talk about that a little bit, but in 2009, I started working on a project about the modern women's movement that a colleague had come to me with and partnered with her, and it involved interviewing 100 groundbreaking women. And so I did a lot of research of women in different areas, in politics, in business, in sports, you know, in the arts, all across the board, who would be the women that you would want to talk to. And we were consulting with Gloria Steinem, and I said, well, of course, we're going to interview Sandra Day O'Connor, the first female Supreme Court justice. And Gloria Steinem said, well, yes, you can interview her, but you must interview Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And, you know, I was so uninformed then. I said, well, yes, she's the second female Supreme Court justice. I did not know what she had done in the 1970s. So it was a complete revelation to me. I had lived through this era, and I didn't know it. And that was, you know, really the beginning of my discovery much more about the women's movement and what so many women have continued to do to help advance the cause for all of us, and including Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And then, of course, a few years later, 2015, my partner Julie Cohn and I decided to launch on a documentary about Justice Ginsburg.
It's when this was during Makers, right?
Yeah. Yeah, this was the project was called Makers, Women Who Make America.
Exactly. And when we watched it, my wife and I watched this, and it was just profound. It was just it was wonderful to be able to be reminded of things that I didn't. I had the pleasure in 1973. I worked for the City Wire Service in Houston, and I got a chance to be there at the very first Women's Superstars competition. They had men's superstars competition at that time, but this was women. So they got, this was the first time those women had met each other.
Right.
And so,
right.
you know, getting a chance to see these women from Sandra Palmer and Wyoming Attias and so many to get together for the first time and just share a little bit of experience. And then this was when to interview Billie Jean and Martina and Chris Everett when they were, and to be able, and it stunned me the difference in the way they were paid, the way they were, but I would not have done that had I not gotten a chance to really dig into it. And so it really began to work on me. And I love it that your work is changing you.
Totally. Yeah, it did. One of the big thrills of my life was meeting Billie Jean King at a screening for the RBG film. And, you know, she is such a hero to me when I realize what she put up with and how she fought back. And I think she, for many years, was an unsung feminist hero. I think now women really understand what Billie Jean King did for everybody. She's an amazing person. And yeah, it did. It changed my perspective. You know, it's a lot of this has made me rethink things that, okay, maybe I was able to overcome the kind of, you know, everyday harassment that would be thrown your way and you kind of slough it off. But when you think about women who perhaps, you know, were just entering the job market, didn't have the level of confidence, felt vulnerable, the kinds of pressures put on those women and how they were exploited. I mean, it pains me that I was a little, you know, oblivious to that and just not considering that. Felt like, well, you know, I know how to take care of these guys, just like, you know, just don't bother me. But that wasn't always so easy for a lot of women. Anyway, yeah.
I agree completely. And this is the amazing thing about seeing, because Justice Ginsburg was criticized by many feminists for her step-by-step approach for building on case law, on building the case little by little to make sure that it would be a solid, especially when we're talking about, and that was her criticism, yet I can so understand it so much more than when I was standing there, well, why can't we just do it all at once?
Yeah. No, it when I was interviewed in Boston by a former federal judge who had been a feminist lawyer in the 1970s, and she said to me, you know, we were frustrated with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who at the time was running the Women's Project at the ACLU, and she was really controlling which cases they were taking on and what cases they were pushing forward. This woman said to me, you know, we wanted her to be much more aggressive, to be pushing harder on, you know, reproductive rights and other areas.
Yep.
And she said, now I realize Ruth was right, you know, that these things, that you have to pace things according to taking into account where society is. And
yes,
I think that's certainly true with some of the changes that have happened in LGBT rights and, you know, marriage equality. And we hope that the pendulum is still bending toward justice,
right,
as Ruth Bader Ginsburg believes.
We have to know, we have to continue that. That's where I think that our opportunity has to go, because there seems to be both the back and forth and the backlash, because when we had the backlash and in with the ERA, and the fact that the ERA did not get passed, and I had that 10-year limit so that it was
right,
stopped. And where do you think the country is, or as far as the understanding, try to be the not Betsy, and the understanding of what the value of having it ensconced in the Constitution that we have an Equal Rights Amendment?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, yes. I think it would be very important. And I think where the country is, I mean, I don't think women are going to go backwards. You know, women are not going to be taking 10 steps backward in this country. I mean, women are leading this country right now. And you just look at the support for for the governors, the Nancy Pelosi, for the women who are in leadership positions, that's not going to go away. You know, whether or not the country is ready to pass an Equal Rights Amendment, I'm not sure. Ruth Bader Ginsburg almost got the Equal Rights Amendment with her work for the, you know, Equal Protection Clause and the 14th Amendment. But it's not quite the same as having it written into the Constitution. I think that, you know, we may not be quite ready for it just because of the way that the structure of having to get the majority of states to pass this and to go through, there will be problems with it. So I just don't know. I think that Justice Ginsburg herself has made comment on this, that she's not sure that it's going to pass in the near future.
Wonder,
women are fighting on other fronts.
Well, this is one of the things that I'm deeply committed to, Betsy, is that the feminist is an important term for me, because it means that it gives me something to aspire to, a balance within me that I can aspire to. It isn't an either or, it's an and gate. It's a bringing together rather than a separating term for all of us, about what are the places within me, the divine feminine and the divine masculine, being able to come together in a place where we can both bring our strengths. So that's the vision that I have. And so I feel very strongly identified with feminism and the feminist movement and what we can do together. Where I want to see more is as you're looking out at the decision makers. I mean, I can see where the genetic decision makers of the Senate and the House and where they are right now. When you're talking about the media, when you get at the high levels of the green lighters, how many women are getting up there? Are we getting more decision makers up there? Are we seeing some splits up there?
Well, I think there has been some progress. I mean, you see the president of CBS News, Susan Zirinsky.
Yes.
She's a very powerful leader, and she has been a force at CBS News for a long time and certainly, earned that job a long time ago. And yet she's still in the minority. There aren't a ton of women who have that kind of responsibility. It's interesting. People have asked Julie and me about women in the film world, and you really have to divide it. There's women in the Hollywood narrative movie world, and there's women in documentary. If you look in the Hollywood narrative world, where movies make bazillions of dollars and, where just, big money is at stake, the numbers are still too low, way too low. I mean, there's been a push, and I think, a recognition that women need to be given opportunities to be directors and others, but they're still lagging. Women are much more present in the documentary world, and I think that really is because there's less money at stake. Documentaries don't make as much money, and so maybe that's why women have gotten those kinds of opportunities. It was for us, for Julie and me, we decided that it would be a good thing on RBG to have a female camera woman to go to the Supreme Court and to do some of the filming. We're thinking, we're doing a story about this, feminist icon. Let's have one of the great women DPs. So Claudia Raschke was our DP. And once we got started on that, we thought, let's have a woman editor and it's not that we didn't work with any men, but on this we did. I mean, there were men on our crews. But it sure was very empowering when we debuted at Sundance and the whole crew came up on the stage and there were about 11 women and there was one guy who was our Peter Nichol, our brave Peter Nichol, who was our second cameraman in Washington. And, it felt good
God,
to make
wonderful.
That statement. But again, that's one small documentary. But I just think people have become more aware of the problem and of the unconscious
Absolutely.
Bias.
And I love that because here's the thing, is that if we're going to make decisions based upon just this entire country or this entire world, we make better decisions if we have both men and women at the table.
Yeah.
It's the population. It's the thought population. What I cannot or will not think about if I do not have a diverse group at the table.
Yeah. Well, that's always been Ruth Bader Ginsburg's argument that, this is not just gender equality is not just helping women. It's helping women and men.
Thank you.
And that has been her one of her foundational beliefs. That's why she talks about gender equality, not equality for women. It's for it's for men and women. It's for men to have the opportunity to have more involvement with their children. That is an advantage for them that perhaps they weren't able to experience before. And as you say, just to have the smartest minds available when we have these ginormous problems that we're facing, you want everybody there.
Oh, amen. Well, when you decided, what, t- take me back to the origin story. Did you go to Julie? Did Julie come to you? Who went first? And just had those very first conversations.
Yeah, well, I worked on the Makers Project. Gloria Steinem said, hey, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We were lucky enough to get an interview with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which I did in, I think, 2011. I was so intimidated to talk to her because by then I had read and realized how important she was.
Oh, my God.
And she's a very intimidating. She's tiny, but she's intimidating, and she's a shy person.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a little nerve-wracking. I did the interview. It went pretty well. It was part of the Makers series. And I know she saw it and she liked it. Julie had done a film called The Sturgeon Queens, which is about a smoked fish store in the Lower East Side called Russ and Daughters, because Russ, the Jewish immigrant, you know, at the turn of the century, only had daughters, so he had to give his store to his daughters in the 1920s. And, you know, it's a beloved store in New York, and Julie sort of told the very funny family history of this thing. And Ruth Bader, as a little girl, used to go there. So Julie wrote to the Supreme Court and got an interview with Justice Ginsburg about her love of smoked fish. So anyway, we had both had these experiences. Julie had also worked with me a little bit on the Makers Project. That's how I met her, was through a mutual friend who I was looking for producer, introducer. So anyway, it's 2015. Julie had put out The Sturgeon Queens, and she was very active on Twitter and Facebook. And she said to me, every time I post something that's about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who by then was now being known as Notorious RBG because she was writing these very stinging dissents as the court is becoming more conservative, and she was writing her tough dissents, and she was called Notorious RBG. Anyway, Julie said to me, every time I post something, it just like goes crazy. Everybody is reposting it, and she's so popular, and she's so – and we were talking one day, and Julie, you know, nobody – knows the full story. These people who think she's so incredible now, they don't even know what she did in the 70s, and they don't know the kinds of challenges that she faced in the 50s and the 60s, and they don't know the love story, which, you know, I knew because I'd done this interview. So it was Julie who said, you know, we should make a documentary. And the minute she said it, I was like, oh my God, you are right. Of course. So, you know, in January of 2015, we wrote her an email to suggest this idea. And so that's the origin.
That's the origin. And how did you two decide? One of the things that I love watching you two do an interview, and there are a number of interviews of you two together, is how you finish one another's sentence, how you pass the thought back and forth, and how it's electric to watch that kind of collaboration of the mind. It's just, how did that work? Did you guys work on that in order to do it? Because you co-directed. Now, this is not something that you normally see out there, so it has to be something that is special and is precious, and I want to talk about it.
Yeah, no, it's totally special. I feel it's just a tremendous gift to have found a partner like this. I mean, frankly, when we talked about doing this, and then, you know, it took about a year to get the project off the ground. So, you know, we were working somewhat on it, but not full time. At one point, somebody said to Julie, she later told me, someone said to Julie, you know, asking her about the idea of co-directing and, you know, what's it going to be like working with a friend and isn't that dangerous? And Julie said something like, well, you know, Betsy and I know each other, but we're not that good friends. So if it doesn't work out, it's okay. and actually, you know, that was true. It was true. We really didn't know each other that well before we embarked on this, but we, it turns out, have, you know, very similar sensibilities. I mean, we've both been in network television news. We are both serious journalists We care about issues. We care about stories that matter, but we also care about stories that people will actually watch. We want to entertain people in addition to informing them. And so we never miss an opportunity for some emotion or a laugh or just bringing some levity to carrying a story about, you know, constitutional law for 90 minutes to get people to watch that story. You've got to really take advantage of every storytelling trick that there is. And we just have a very similar thought process about it. I mean, it's unbelievable, but we never had a serious fight in the whole time we were doing RBG. I mean, for example, let's say we look at a section of it and, you know, we might both say that's not working, that doesn't work. We might have a disagreement how to fix it. Like I might say, oh, let's just do more of this. And she might say, oh no, let's completely change it and do something else. And then we say, okay, we'll try both. And then our wonderful editor, Carla, would kind of mock up both. And inevitably, one or the other of us would say, oh, yeah, you're right, that's better. I mean, we just think the same way about things. And that is, you know, you can't really learn that. It's just, it just happens. And we feel very lucky. So,
well, it is, and you developed it. But some of the ways, one of the underpinnings that I loved about RGB, so many things, and I have so many notes, but the way that you built it upon the law and the decisions and the dissent and the way that you used the empty Supreme Court bench and then half dissolve with the law, with the dissent underneath, with the highlighted where you put the particular words and then had that riveted me. It gave me the understanding of how to do the law and why the law was important, why you had to include it, but yet had it in such a captivating way. That was astonishing.
Well, thank you. I mean, we worked hard at it with our wonderful graphics team. We were very lucky that we were able to go into the Supreme Court with a Steadicam and get those beautiful shots of the empty room. And, you know, I think it really helped that Julie did a one-year master's at Yale in the law school, you know, maybe 2 decades ago. She really understands the law. I mean, I can make my way through the briefs, but I think, you know, a lot of what we were doing was taking these cases and making them understandable to people who, you know, aren't lawyers. That was the whole point.
Yep.
And we also made a sort of strategic decision to focus on cases where there were living clients. So we had Stephen Weisenfeld, whose you know, wife had died in childbirth, and his very poignant story about fighting for his Social Security benefits, and Sharon Frontiero, the Air Force lieutenant, who suddenly realized that she was being denied the kinds of benefits that her male colleagues were getting. And they were both just so relatable. And, you know, I think it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg's strength in a lot of the cases that she always has a humanity at the core of her case. You know, there's stories about people. It's injustice being done to a person who represents a lot of people. And so, you know, I think we were so lucky that we were able to interview those people and to tell their stories, which are really at the heart of these, you know, gigantic legal battles.
Yeah. And you even brought in the part where she made the mistake of criticizing candidate Trump, bringing that in, which I thought was just a beautiful piece to be able to round it out and it gave it a wonderful piece of understanding, rather than this just being a pay-on to everything that she did that was just exactly perfect.
Yeah, I mean, look, she's a human being. And
amen.
And she makes, you know, as Orrin Hatch said, she made a mistake, and
yep.
she admitted the mistake. This was some, you know, I actually did have somebody once ask me in a Q&A, like, why did you include that? You know, that wasn't necessary. And
Julie
and I felt it was completely necessary. That
it was,
you know, it was
so
a misstep,
important. And
you know, it wasn't just her critics who took her to task. It was her
yep.
supporters who said, wait a minute, don't do that. And
mm-hmm.
I think it showed that she's a human being and not a perfect person. So that was something
we
had to do.
And I loved it. So how many rough cuts did you go through? And were there any major changes? I mean, when you first sit down and you go, okay, it's linear. I mean, I loved the hip hop beginning and having the work. I mean, it just really, and then getting into her early life and to decide where, but take us, dig into the creative process and tell us about that.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, we did not want to tell the story chronologically because we have a living subject who is fascinating. And so we wanted to be able to have scenes with Justice Ginsburg start throughout the movie. And including, you know, we had to show her working out, for crying out loud, at the beginning
yes.
of the movie. And then, of course, it comes in, you know, a longer section later on. So the trick was to figure out how to weave back and forth in time to present her today and also kind of chronologically tell her story of growing up in Brooklyn, going to Cornell, meeting Marty, going to Harvard, the sexism, the, you know, like just taking use of her life. And our wonderful editor, Carla Gutierrez, sat at home for about 5 weeks and looked through all our interviews and looked at all the archive. And one day she said, you know, the Senate confirmation hearings when she was appointed to be Supreme Court Justice went on for 4 days, and Carla watched the whole thing. She said a lot of it was so boring and tedious, I cannot tell you. However, she said there were moments in the hearing where she was really almost presenting her life in such a straightforward way. And Carla, it was Carla's suggestion that we use the Senate confirmation as a kind of tent pole to structure the film. And it allowed you to go back and forth in time. So if we went to the Senate confirmation hearings and she talked about, you know, growing up as, you know, she's a child of immigrants, and then she goes to Cornell, and then the luckiest thing that happened in her life was meeting Marty Ginsburg, and then we go into the wonderful home movies that we were very lucky to have found. So that's the kind of early life section that we had. And then, you know, we found a transition to be able to see her at the opera, the Santa Fe Opera, enjoying
yeah.
opera, which is really her passion. And so the trick was to figure out how you could do those transitions so that they would feel seamless, that you wouldn't just kind of be going, wait a minute, why am I here? You know, what's happening now? And we had a board that had the different scenes that we were working on, and, you know, we would kind of rearrange where they went. Certainly things moved around as we were
yeah.
cutting it. I mean, one of the things that would happen is, like, after a long legal section, one of us would look at the other and say, I think we need some Marty. You know, and we do a Marty scene because we, you know, it's a little levity, and it would kind
yeah.
of just lift the film up. So it was a question of just kind of balancing these various scenes. I can't remember how many there were, maybe 30, something like that, on this board, little poster things that we would just kind of move. They were all labeled, and we would just, okay, what if we go to them shaking hands in the court every morning after this section, you know, and then we move it there and try it. So, I mean, I don't know how many rough cuts there were. Many, 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 many.
Oh, many, many, many. The number is not important. The importance is to recognize them, because I'm much more interested in the process. The thing is, Betsy, is that I love the aha moment and hearing about those aha moments when somebody gets the idea that the double helix and Watson and Crick and is one of my favorite examples. But I'm also interested in what was it like 2 hours before that? What was it like 2 weeks before that? What about a year before that, that if that had not happened, that moment would not have occurred?
Yeah. I mean, there are times when you're just like, you know, you're looking at all of this material and thinking, how are we going to organize this? How are we going to do this? Like, it just feels overwhelming. And then again, it's just step by step. You just break it down into manageable. I think Carla did a really smart thing in editing that section about, she had a very clear vision for how to tell the early story. And the story of Ruth, basically Ruth going to Cornell and meeting Marty and deciding to become a lawyer, and early on, and it really was inspiring, because it just, you saw those home movies, and I remember Julie and I looking at each other and just going, wow, this is going to work, you know. So you just work from section to section, you just break it down, and, you know, one of us would take the VMI story and try to put that together on a script and then hand it to Carla and see how that came out. And the other one would be working on the Weisenfeld case and, you know, just step by step. I mean, we're doing it now, working on two different documentaries, and that's what we're in the middle of now, is the puzzle. I was thinking last night, it's like doing, like, you know, I like to do the New York Times crossword puzzle. It's like, okay, you finish the puzzle and you feel a sense of accomplishment, but then it's gone. It's over. You know, whereas this is like, you know, it's like working on a puzzle for 2 years until it's finally done.
And what did you run out of time, or did one of you or the other go, we're done?
Well, we had a budget and we had deadlines. So that's really how it works.
How wonderful.
You just can't keep going and going and going. You have to meet a deadline. And, you know, sometimes that means you work on the weekends. You know, that didn't happen a lot, but it did happen a few times where we had to make the deadline. We really wanted to go to Sundance, and so part of our deadline was being able to submit it in time for Sundance and being able to show it to our producing partner, CNN Films, before then and get their notes. And, you know, they were looking at cuts throughout the summer. So we're just meeting our various deadlines.
Oh, boy, I have so much more I would like to talk with you about that process, about getting notes. Because notes are so important, and being able to have that tension between what note you will accept, how to push back, how not. But we will save that for another time, you possibly consent to talk about it. However, how are you a better storyteller and a better filmmaker for having gone through this process with you and Julie and Carla and all the team that do that? Are you able to reflect on that? Are you able to see that you built those muscles like Ruth does in the gym because you went through this?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's given me a lot of confidence that I can do it. And I think that's half the battle when you're facing something really challenging, just to think, okay, I did that. I guess I can do this, even though it seems really overwhelming. I think that having a partnership has, I hope, caused me to be a little bit more considerate of another person and to really think about their point of view, I hope. It's not just me all the time. And to be grateful for that and grateful for the whole team. So I guess, it's been a profound event in my life, and I'm happy that it happened. So grateful.
In addition to teaching, what is on your narrative plate right now that you're working on that you can share?
Yeah, that I can share. Well, we're working on two documentaries. One of them has not been announced, but it's actually closer to being completed. It's the one that we're really wrestling to the ground right now. But I can't really talk about it. It's about, both of these are about women. I'm very excited about how it's coming out. I think it's going to be really good. The other one, which we are also working on, is about someone you have heard of, and it has been announced. It's about Julia Child. And this is a film really about a woman who changed American attitudes toward food, changed television, and changed, mm-hmm. you know, the world for women. I mean, she had an enormous impact, and she's just a great character. Just a wonderful story. I can relate to the fact that she really was a later in life bloomer. She didn't even write her iconic cookbook wasn't published till she was 50 years old, and then became a television star for the next three decades, which is a wonderful story to me. And there's a great love story too.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you'll bring all these, and this is, I'm following the Grandma Moses model of
exactly.
success. That's where I'm following. So
yeah.
I'm going, it is, because when we're talking about diversity, I want to make sure and of course I have complete self-interest in this. I like to think about it as enlightened self-interest, but it is that we want to make sure, just like that when we put millennials into a box, that's a damaging place. Put women into a box, put Asians into a box, putting the elders in the tribe in a box, and just, you know, grumpy old farts who are over there, and just get them off of the stage, to say that there is value to having diversity around, age diversity as well as all, and that's what I'm excited about. About
I'm with
bringing...
you, Dennis. I'm there.
Is there anything that you, Betsy, were not asked that you really wanted to talk about during all of? Because you know now you have to promote your own stuff. That's the reality of it. So is there anything that hadn't been talked about enough that you want to focus on for RGB, RBG?
You know, boy, the film got so much attention, and it touched so many different kinds of audiences that surprised us tremendously. I mean, I think we knew that RBG was a popular figure with millennial women. We knew that older women were going to completely identify with what she went through. I did not realize that making a film that had a lawyer as the hero was going to bring us a whole audience of lawyers and judges who really found our... And, you know, men who were... happy. I had a number of men say thank you for presenting a feminist man and making,
yes.
you know, and showing what he did. And I was happy. But the kind of the coolest thing was just the number of little girls who came to our screenings. I mean, they would show up sometimes dressed up like RBG with their glasses and their hair pulled back, carrying a gavel or a collar, wearing a collar. I mean, who knew that we were making a movie for, you know, for kids, but it turned out to be that way. And that was a real discovery to me, that this older woman, I mean, that young people really do identify with older people. Sometimes mm-hmm. it skips over their parents and the grandparents can be very inspiring to them. And I think she is one of those figures that little girls see. Here she is, teeny little woman who is holding her gavel and holding people to account, and they find that very powerful. So
she's certainly holding me to account. Exactly. She's holding me to account, and Betsy, you're holding me to account, because this is one of the, this is, I do this because I want to be inspired, because I want to continue, because I run on inspiration. I run on seeing other people and sharing with other people who are looking inside of themselves and bringing themselves to their best of the table. Because unless you've been facing the blank page, sitting there going, oh, let's get this idea, and then saying, okay, how are we going to execute it? Well, that's the magic. The magic is doing the footwork and taking that those step by step to be able to bring something until it finally comes on to the screen. And that inspires me.
Well, thank you for having a chance to talk about it. I just want to say one thing also about New York and how great it is. Every night at 7 o'clock in New York, there's banging, clanging, shouting, horns honking every night at 7 o'clock to thank the essential workers. I mean, it's extraordinary. And, it's a very tough time, but I feel the determination and almost the defiance, determination and spirit of the city. It's very exciting to be here now, in addition to, a little scary, but exciting.
And to have, the thing that I love about it is because when I look into when you're talking about the children who come to RBG, I'm sorry, because I'm in television, because I came from television,
everybody
think of RGB as just, I've used that term for so long, I have a hard time getting there. But anyhow, is to sit down, when I look into their eyes, Betsy, I see something so powerful and so committed and so, and I go, yeah, things are going to be okay. It may be bumpy, but things are going to be okay because these kids are woke.
Yep, they are. I agree. And
it's wonderful.
My hope in my 25-year-old and all of her, her generation.
In Montana.
Yep.
And she, all right. Thanks again. And May, and when are you going to be announcing, or when are you going to be going into production for the, or into for these next films?
Yeah. Release. Well, the coronavirus will hold up probably the finishing of the films. We're working on them, but we won't be able to post them until we're through with this. I think, I hope they'll both be coming out next year. I'm hoping.
Well, I'm going to get in on as soon as I can possibly get in on through your schedule to be able to talk about it, and we can go from there. I would love to continue our conversation. Thank you, Betsy.
Thank
you for all you're doing, and for all you and Julie and Carla and all the that were involved in this extraordinary process, and also for the work that you've done over your career and what you're doing. So we're going to keep following it, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks, Betsy.
Thank you, Dennis. Have a good day down there in Texas. Bye.